I did just want to make one comment for anybody planning on speaking and for the Planning Commission. To be sure to please speak into the mic. It will be the official record, will be this audio, so we need to make sure that we capture all of it.
All right, well, good evening. We'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to the April 25th meeting of the Planning Commission. We'll start off with introductions from our far left.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Hello, my name is Spencer Segment from North Kitsap.
Rick Shattuck from Central Kitsap.
Joe Phillips from Central.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Gina Buskirk, Central Kitsap.
Robert Baglio, South Kitsap. And we have the agenda before us. Any need to make any modifications? Okay. Seeing none, I guess a motion for approval.
I move the agenda.
Second.
See no need for discussion. All in favor? Okay. We also have approval of the meeting minutes from April 18th. I assume we've all had an opportunity to review those. Is there a motion for approval?
Move to approve the minutes.
I'll second that.
Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, all those in favor? Opposed? Abstained. All right. Okay, so with that, we're going to not open the public hearing, but get started for the public hearing. I believe that staff does have, Kathleen, a little introduction into critical areas as far as kind of what we've done and I guess preparation at this point in time.
Well, good evening, Planning Commission. For the record, Kathleen Barnhart, Planner, Kitsap County Department of Community Development. We are here this evening to hold the first of three public hearings being offered on Title 19 Critical Areas Ordinance Update. Before we begin, I would like to take a few moments to review why we're here and a little bit of background information. First up, the Growth Management Act of Washington requires counties and cities to review and evaluate comprehensive plans and the development regulations and update them if necessary according to a schedule established in the RCW. Kitsap County adopted its comprehensive plan in June of 2016. The county's review of development regulations included the Critical Areas Ordinance in Kitsap County Code Title 19, or CAO. Kitsap County's last update to the CAO was in 2005, some limited amendments in 2007. This current update is intended to ensure compliance with state and federal mandates, incorporation of any best available science since the 2005 update, consideration and incorporation of recent growth management hearing board decisions, and correction of code conflicts or other internal inconsistencies. Local jurisdictions are granted a one-year grace period beyond the deadline for their comprehensive plans. As such, Kitsap County's CAO update is due by June 30th of this year, 2017. In the summer of 2016, Kitsap County staff convened an informal working group comprised of technical experts from the applicable state resource agencies of ecology, natural resources, and fish and wildlife, and tribes, as well as representatives from some key stakeholder organizations. This group reviewed the current CAO alongside the bibliography and summary of best available science, the county's initial review of best available science since the last update. After incorporating feedback from this external working group, internal and legal review, the draft critical areas ordinance was released for public review and comment from March 1st through 31st, 2017. During this time, Kitsap County provided a 24/7 online open house forum, in addition to three traditional in-person open houses, one in each commissioner district. The invitation was also provided to meet and discuss with any interested organization. During the comment period, Kitsap County received approximately 400 individual comments in the form of letters, emails, and online submissions. Those were provided to the Planning Commission and posted online in three forms on April 18th. So you will have the original comments in the comment letters and online public comment matrix. Comment summary matrix, which summarized all the comments received, and then the summary response matrix, which compiled comments by topic or code sections with the county's response. Planning Commission held two work studies on the draft CAO, April 4th and 18th. Just to very briefly summarize Summarize the proposed changes discussed very briefly, I promise. Chapter 100, Introduction and Approval Procedures. We looked at such things as exemptions for pre-existing and ongoing agriculture based on a recent finding from the Growth Management Hearings Board. We had some conversation around the provisions for danger tree removals in critical areas. Definitions. There were changes to the definitions largely for consistency with applicable state agency guidelines. Some were deleted because they are defined in other code chapters. They still apply, but will reduce the odds of conflicting definitions should one change. And some were added to provide better clarity to code. Chapter 200, Wetlands. Since 2014, Kitsap County has been operating under the revised wetland rating system. We are proposing changes to this chapter to match the revised system, including scoring for wetland categories. There are three particular scenarios where standard wetland buffers would increase, but also three that would decrease. All are for category one or two wetlands, which are not particularly common in Kitsap County. This draft does include a proposed reduction in allowance for administrative buffer reductions, but also provides more options and flexibility for mitigation options. Chapter 300, Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Areas. We removed a lot of references for shorelines where appropriate. These are now regulated under the Shoreline Master Program, or Title 22 of Kitsap County Code. We looked at changes to how bald eagles are managed and other changes similar to what we saw in the wetlands chapter. Chapter 400, Geologically Hazardous Areas. This chapter needed enough updates and reorganization that it looks quite different, but by and large, the development standards are the same. The maps have been updated using mostly the same criteria, but using technologies far advanced of what was available during the drafting of the current map. Frequently Flooded Areas references Title 15 Flood Hazard Area, which was recently updated. Chapter 600, Critical Aquifer Recharge Areas. We've looked at water quantity as an added consideration. And our special reports, there was more clarity to the already required elements provided. And the appendices were minor edits consistent with code and some new templates and checklists added. And I realize that is an extremely brief summary, but there you go. Before we move forward, I would like to add that we have received many excellent public comments and had some very productive conversations so far. We have also been working closely with our prosecuting attorney's office to address multiple court cases mentioned in some of those comments. In addition to tonight's hearing, there will also be a second hearing this Thursday, April 27th at Poulsbo City Hall, and a third May 2nd in Port Orchard in the Kitsap County Administration Building. Both have an open house beginning at 5 and a hearing beginning at 6. Staff would like to recommend to the Planning Commission that the record for public comment be kept open through the May 2nd public hearing in Port Orchard. That's for your consideration. Following the May 2nd hearing, the Planning Commission will hold deliberations on May 16th and 23rd, and on June 6th, this Planning Commission's recommendations and comments will be formalized and sent to the Board of County Commissioners for their consideration. So with that, I have nothing further to add at this time, unless there are any clarifying questions or any additional. Thank you.
I don't think so.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. So once again, the sign-up sheet is back here. If you would, leave a couple there in case people do come in. But if you are interested in speaking, please sign up on the sheet. And also, as she stated, when you come in and or come up to the podium, if you would, please state your name and address for the record. And that way we have the information. Looks like we only have 9 people signed up at this point in time. So what I'm going to say is you can actually speak if you care to for 5 minutes. You don't have to use 5 minutes, but we'll skip 5 minutes. And we're just going to go in order. So if I mispronounce your name, I do apologize. But the first one, it looks like Dean.
Jennings.
Thank you.
Well, because I disagree with the interpretation of the GMA, I'm going to approach this a little differently. I've submitted quite a few comments along with a lot of other. So here we go. As a planning board, you are the citizen's representative in council to the county commissioners in controlling the overreach of government. Question, is this document required? I don't believe it is. Why isn't this document formulated under the legal guidelines of do no harm? It's so critical that it is logical to assume wetland value should exceed property values without wetlands. As a planning commission, have you even considered the public research comments provided in the 22-page spreadsheet matrix, and there's three of them? Has the Planning Commission challenged any aspect of this ordinance? Has your input into this egregious document reflected the land issue court cases? For example, Swinomish Tribe versus Western Washington. Hearing board and Supreme Court decision states, best available science is not mandatory, and stated riparian buffers are not required. That's a legal document. Why then are buffers even required around wetlands? It is inferred wetlands protect habitat. What species within specific habitat is being protected? According to the species list produced by the state, none live in Kitsap County. Consider this. How can wetland areas be classified critical when they can be mitigated and have variances? If buffers are not required along streams and shorelines per case law, has the board challenged or taken steps to reduce or eliminate restrictions in this area? To improve an ordinance, baseline should have been established along with measures of effectiveness. There are no measurements. Without measurements of effectiveness, what justification does the need for this ordinance have? The content of the CAO is covered by all intents and purposes within the building permit process. Also, without CAO metrics, you cannot justify any changes to the document other than those presented in case law. You seem to be ignoring all the case laws. The planning goal listed in GMA RCW 3678.020 are general in nature. Nowhere is the CAO required. Of the 13 plus goals, number 6 states, private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation having been made. The property rights of landowners shall be protected from arbitrary and discriminatory actions. This CAO is exactly that, arbitrary and discriminatory. Recommend the Planning Commission do their diligence and question the content of this document and its requirements per the case laws available. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for him? Okay, thank you. Next on the list, Teresa Ozinski. Oh, and also, so we do have a timer over here, so if by chance you do run long, you'll get an arm wave at 1 minute. So just so you know, there is a timer over here.
There will be a beep at a halfway point and then a final beep.
Okay.
Also, yeah.
Pressure's on. Good evening, I'm Teresa Osinski. I'm the Executive Officer of Kitsap Building Association. Thank you all for your service to the county and for being here tonight and offering us this opportunity to comment on the draft critical areas ordinance. I'd like to first thank the county staff. We've had a really great opportunity to work with them, reviewing the draft and helping them to understand some of the ground truthing and the reality of terminology. So we've pulled together geotechnical experts, wetland experts, and as well as many of our developers to look at the draft and really talk with the county in a conversational way about the implications of how these words will ultimately affect applicants who will be relying on this technical legislation as they move forward on behalf of property owners throughout Kitsap County. So oftentimes, as you know, property owners really don't understand or pay attention to the technical issues that go into creating code. They don't think about it because they either already own their property and are using it currently in the way they wish to use it in the future, or maybe they're not property owners yet. And so to try to attract their attention to the technicalities of these things is very, very difficult. And as an association, well, our members are largely business owners. Many of those business owners represent the consumers in this community. So we find ourselves frequently the voice of the unsuspecting public. They really don't know what they don't know. And unfortunately, many of them won't find out for many years down the road, and this whatever you adopt will ultimately be in place for some time probably by then. So we'd like to avoid any unintended consequences, and that's why we've taken the time to come here tonight to provide you comment. I have submitted in writing several page detailed comments from the Kitsap Building Association. I provided staff tonight with copies for each of you, and I'm not going to read that to you. I trust that you can read that and digest it, but though I may not speak about every point in our written comments, I want to make it very, very clear that we stand very committed to every one of those points, and I would encourage you to take those very seriously and to do everything you can to help us to achieve success with regards to our recommended direction for this document. I will touch on a few things, though, that I just want to highlight and call your attention to. We would caution the county to be very, very careful to not go beyond what is absolutely necessary based on a interpretation of the best available science. You don't need to go past that. So let's try to stay very, very close to that. And let's also recognize that in Kitsap County, we are one jurisdiction. Best available science is typically designed and written and reviewed on a more comprehensive basis and not necessarily germane to Kitsap specific. So we ask that you please encourage wherever possible to hold staff very closely to best available science and to allow as much local discretion as possible. Secondarily, I would say that it's important that you ensure that there continues to be buffer averaging allowed in Kitsap County, and that in addition to that, that you are careful to make sure that the buffers can be administratively reduced and not placing the burden of full hearings on anybody who's requesting to reduce the buffer beyond 25%, which is what I think the current draft would limit folks to in using administrative review. It's quite onerous. Buffers sometimes do need to be reduced, and we want property owners to be able to use their property while recognizing and protecting the environmental concerns on their land. We would also ask you to encourage the draft to recognize a delayed implementation date. We found with recent technical codes like the Stormwater Code, for example, this was a huge burden on the county, on its staff, getting them fully prepared to handle applications under the new technical code, and this is not going to be terribly different from that. They're still adjusting to staffing changes. We would ask for the benefit of the professionals in the community that must help navigate their clients through this process, as well as the county staff itself, that you put in there or encourage them to adopt a 6-month delay in the implementation of the final adopted code. Finally, in my 41 seconds, I would like to suggest that you minimize third-party review wherever possible. When it is necessary, be sure to extend the department's policy regarding backreaching. In other words, when the county brings in somebody from out of the area to do a third-party review, they don't usually come with the local expertise, and that can become very costly to the applicant, can take up additional delay time, and we would ask that you encourage staff to reduce and avoid the use of outside third-party reviewers whenever possible on these issues related to the critical areas on properties. As I said, we've submitted a 5-page list of comments. They're all important to us, and I hope that you will take the time to review them thoughtfully. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? All right, thank you. Next up, Ron Gillespie.
Ron Gillespie, just live on Tracyton Boulevard. I'd like to start by saying I tend to disagree with almost everything that Dean Jenica says, so just put that on the other side of the ledger right there.
That's because I know
you're welcome. And my main concern tonight is mitigation of wetlands. And I think you can mitigate wetlands by enhancing them and so forth. But to say that you can take a wetlands and then mitigate it by moving it someplace else doesn't sound like it's just geologically correct. Wetlands are in a place for a reason. And to say to put a wetlands where there isn't a wetlands now and say that it's going to serve the same purpose as the original one did, I think is logically wrong. And so I really argue that mitigation of that sort should be prohibited, and that wetlands should be recognized that they're in a place where they need to be and let them stay there. You're not going to move them around. And if you can't build on it, you can't build on it. I suffer the consequence when wetlands have been moved upstream from me because the water needs to go someplace, and it had a nice place to pop up on my property. Let nature serve its course, and we need to sort of respect the environment of how things naturally occur. Thank you.
Thank you. No questions? All right, next up, Levi Holmes.
Hi, my name is Levi, and I'd like to just say that I tend to agree with everything that Teresa said, and also would like to recommend the memo that KBA has submitted with some recommendations. And I work in the industry doing development. We do a lot of affordable housing, we do senior housing, we do some commercial projects. So we've done a lot of different areas of the county. And one of the big things I'd like to just tell you guys is that the more tools we have for site-specific critical areas and habitats is really important, because everything is, every project is different. Every landscape is different, and we need all the tools that we have currently, and taking some of those away can really make projects not any better, but actually just hinder it in a way that isn't necessarily the intent that the DOE may have, the state may have, and that this county has. And a lot of these mandates are very broad. They're for a lot of different jurisdictions, a lot of different topography, a lot of different sites, and it's hard to narrow it down for each site what we should do. And so being able to take the knowledge of the consultants we have locally and the people that have site-specific knowledge is really important, that each project can take advantage of the different areas and things that make those projects work the way they should and be the best for the environment and the community. I also think it's really important to have a delayed implementation, as Teresa also said, just because it allows applicants and county staff to all get on board with what the new code is. It's kind of a evolving document until it's adopted, and so it's hard to know exactly what's going to be in there and plan a project, especially if you're halfway through and then you submit and everything has changed. So having that 6-month delay is really important for applicants and for county staff to make that process a little smoother. The other part that is a big thing we've recommended is the code tends to just address residential uses. It doesn't really address non-residential uses specifically. And it's my understanding in the past the county has had a policy to apply the entire critical area ordinance to all uses. And we'd like to see that formally included in this draft so that people who have non-residential uses know exactly how that code applies to their particular use. So that's all I have to say. Again, I want to just make the same recommendation about this memo that KBA has submitted to the record.
Levi, just for the record, your address?
Yeah. It's 16233 Pearson Road, Moscow, Washington.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I had a quick question.
Yeah.
You talked about keeping the tools, but didn't mention it. We heard Teresa talk about buffer averaging and administrative ability to reduce buffers as opposed to going full carrying. Are there other, I assume those are the kind of tools?
Yeah, I'd say those are the same. Another one, and I'm hoping that Robin Myers will be able to talk about this as well, but there's a new tool that they're suggesting about creating wildlife corridors, and it's very difficult to do because you need 100-foot width and you have to connect to an adjacent habitat. And a lot of times to have two habitats that aren't currently connected on the same property would be very unlikely. So you'd probably be approaching adjacent property owners trying to get them to cooperate, and then you have to create a conservation easement, which would be a legal process as well. And so to go through all of that, We actually created a table to show the current way it's written. You really wouldn't get much more than you would through a buffer, administrative buffer reduction. So to go through that process, you're not gaining anything, maybe a few feet max extra. And so we were recommending that you be able to get a greater reduction by creating those corridors, because otherwise it just won't be implemented. And one other thing I wanted to mention that I just remembered is that there were some issues with the redline copies. Some of the crossouts were not part of the original code. So somewhere somebody changed something and somehow accidentally where it shows the crossout and the changes are not actually the original code. They must have been some rendition in between. And so there is a little bit of concern about how accurate the crossout version is and how that relates to the original document.
Okay, thank you. Just out of curiosity, they said they had met with you. Is that a handful of errors? Is that just limited as far as where there might have been?
We're not familiar, and so if you can cite those specific instances, we'd love to have take a look at those.
Are those by chance noted in the comments that were submitted?
No, they were not.
Okay. Let's see. Next up, Michael Gustafson.
Could Alan be preceding? He's got information to please them well.
Yeah, certainly. Alan, is it Ream or Beam?
Beam.
Beam, okay.
My name is Alan Beam. I'm from Central Kitsap. I live in Amatai. By training, I'm a geologist. I'm going to talk to you today about wildlife. So I've had a wonderful tour of wildlife for the last couple of weeks going through the document. The first thing that I discovered was the county does a wonderful job of defining what a Class 1 and a Class 2 wildlife conservation area is. But it stops there. They don't tell me what are we trying to protect, where are they, and what means that are we using to protect them. This becomes a big issue when you start looking at what are the particular species that the state says are applicable for Kitsap County. The first one is the only endangered terrestrial species in Kitsap County by the state is the Pacific pound turtle. Pacific pound turtle, if you go to the recovery discussion, says they're only located in Kittitas and Skamania counties with a breeding group in Pierce County. We don't have it. You go to the myrtle barley, which is one of the threatened species, only grows in habitat old growth forests, not here. So you start going down the list and you go to the map, which is right there, and say, okay, show me where the wildlife here conservation areas are. The only thing they show is streams. They don't tell you what the species are. They don't tell the property owner where the critical areas are. They don't tell you what kind of protections they're going to impose. As a property owner, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. Now, there are 15 species that the state won't tell you where they are, including the ground squirrel, bats. To get that, you have to sign a security restriction, and then they'll only give it to you to a certain quarter township sizes. If this is going to be a working document, there has to be a repository in the county that says, what are the species, where are they, and what are we trying to protect? We go through this wonderful definition of wetlands, and it's a 164-page document by the state on how to classify wetlands. If you go through that process, it says you need a classification, you need a habitability management plan, and you also need a mitigation plan. You go do those, you spend the money to get those documents. What do they use them for? They take all that classification document and boil it down to a number, 1 through 64. They take that and they marry that with the intensity, how many places per acre around it, and it comes up with a punch to table for a buffer. I just spent $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to do hypothetically, to do all this work, and then we don't do the site-specific. We hire professionals, they come in, they've done the surveys. Why can't we let them set the buffers and do it site-specific. There's no provision for that. I've talked about wetlands. The other thing that's interesting is every time there's a county document that comes out with a code, Title II gets put in there for inspection. We fought that every time it's come in. It's back in at this time. Title II and this code violates RCW 59.18.150, which tells you what the county can do for code enforcement and what they can do for inspection. And it's beyond me why this is the third try at trying to implement that in this document. The other problem we get into, and this the Suquamish has done a wonderful job, is they've documented that the major problem we're having with salmon habitat is runoff off the roads. And they've come up with some simple buffers that work. You're putting all these restrictions on the property owners, but the real problem is on the roads and the drainage from the roads and not being buffered properly. I suggest that if we want to do real science, we go back to Suquamish and we figure out how to do that and what's causing the problem. The other thing you get into is notice to title. That's very difficult for me because that's a taking. And we've got to work on this document to make it other than generality. Right now it looks like this document is aimed at protecting the county from state requirements. There's nothing in this document that protects the homeowner. Property owner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, that puts me next.
Yes, Michael.
Well, I second to thank you for your work. The three of us that are currently very active on the discussion side sat on your side of the table the last time when we filled this room, if Tom Evans remembers, twice at midnight, two nights in a row. The purpose of the critical areas ordinance is to protect critical creatures. As you just heard, we don't have any. Mr. Shattuck, you asked a question at the last work study. Your staff will tell you how big the buffers were, where they are. The maps over here we had the county produce as a result of the last review of the critical areas ordinance. The yellow is pretty darn close to exactly the buffers. The yellow is supposed to be the buffers, and that's darn close to what they really totally are. There are only a few changes to buffers in the current draft. I submitted for your edification and pleasure three documents earlier. One was the Suquamish Indian Tribe versus Growth Management Hearing Board decision. One was a list of critical endangered species, which includes the blue whale, grizzly bear, and the gray whale, and of course the wolf. We don't have very many here. Suquamish is interesting because in 2007, 2 years after we did the review, the Growth Management Hearing Board and the State Supreme Court both said, we've had enough arm waving. You must now submit specific benchmarks. You must have a plan to improve the population of whatever you identify. Benchmarks are not included in this draft, and they have to be in order to pass muster. In my draft, I showed a number of disconnects. One was in the paragraph of applicability, paragraph 110. Kitsap shall not grant any permit, the word is any, license or other development approval to alter the condition of any land, water, or vegetation, and so forth. But the SDAP, the Site Development Application Permit, allows without permit three basic things. You can clear an acre of land without a permit. You can move 5,000 square feet of dirt without a permit, and you can lay down 5,000 square feet of hardscape without a permit.
It appears to me that the drafter of the document didn't talk to the rest of the staff in doing the review. There are a number of disconnects like that, and I've submitted that in my 33-page document. Along with that, I included 11 Supreme Court cases that bear directly on this document, both state and federal Supreme Court. There are 50 violations that I could count in the draft. You'll find those cases are all italicized in the document I gave you. Those need to be brought into conformance. We are faced with three choices. We can continue to submit a 2005 document with no changes. That is allowed by the GMA. Unfortunately, you'll be hammered immediately by the Department of Ecology and a few other folks because you're way out of date on court decisions and on their wetland stipulations. That's option one. Option two, you can go forward with the current draft. Well, I just told you what happened with court cases there, including issues like buffer averaging. When you average a buffer, you're allowing a person to put their building closer to the critical area than otherwise be allowed, which brings into question why is the requirement there to start with? And then you're putting an extra buffer on the backside of the property, which has absolutely nothing to do with the critical area, strictly as punishment. That doesn't pass muster before the court either. Also, you can't ask for money to be put into a fund for mitigation of wetlands. That's specifically spoken to in the Coons case from Florida. Exactly. Money is defined as property by the U.S. Supreme Court. In that case, you can't do that, but it's in our draft. So what's critical? We have found the Department to justify it at all. Best available science must be real science. It must be local science.
Try to wrap up.
Okay. The cost of permits, including the critical areas ordinance, add an extra $40,000 to $70,000 to the price of a home in Kitsap County. That makes homelessness more prevalent. Housing is just too expensive. There are no migratory animals that I know of in Kitsap County, and I really question the wildlife order concept, because I don't know who's wandering around. That's critical. And the other part about that buffer, that path goes across freeways, which is real tough on the animals. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Next on the list, Judy Krigsman. Judith Krigsman. No?
Oh, she's coming.
She's coming.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
At 5171 Illahee Road. I came here tonight to support the critical areas ordinance because I believe philosophically it is a good document if it's enforced. I once heard an old native proverb that went something like this: the frog in the pond does not eat up the pond in which he lives. In other words, we must protect nature, for nature is our vital asset that we all enjoy. Tonight, we will hear the pros and cons of the CAO. But at the end of the evening, science will not be silenced, and the CAO will be approved with certain changes. With regard to these changes, the Illahee Preserve Stewardship Committee has passed a motion which was approved at their stewardship meeting on April the 18th. The motion, which was approved, reads as follows. The Illahee Preserve Stewardship Committee finds omissions and mistakes in the current draft of the CAO mapping Regarding one, steep slope designation for the Hillicky Creek Corridor. Two, stream designation missing for Steel Creek headwaters in the Hillicky Preserve. And the last and third, wetland designations are missing for the same area. The stewardship group requests that the Department of Community Development address the omissions and accuracy of the mapping regarding the above issues. I will attach a copy of the stewardship minutes. Thank you for all you do. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Questions? Next on the list, Mark Coleman. I would like to say there's only one more name on the list, so if you have arrived late and you do want to speak, I believe there's another sign-up sheet back there. If you want to put your name on that.
My name is Mark Coleman. I'm with Team 4 Engineering, 5819 Northeast Minder Road, Paulsville, Washington. My review of the critical area ordinance, there was one particular topic that brought me to tonight's meeting, and that is the buffer averaging and the buffer reduction tools. Those two tools are very important for application of land use, development of the community. I don't know how many times I've encountered wetlands that have a funny little finger that sticks out someplace that makes a big impact on the property, or can preclude access from the property's legal access point. Buffer averaging and buffer reduction is not your first choice. Avoidance is the first choice according to the critical area ordinance. We don't get to get to buffer averaging or buffer reduction until we've shown why we can't avoid. So there's no real reason that I can see to attack that tool. That tool is very important to us after we get permission to even use that tool. There's really not much in the critical area ordinance that evaluates the quality of buffers. I don't know how many times in my career I've done a project where the buffer is a degraded pasture, degraded to the point where it's been grazed on summer, winter, and fall, to the point where vegetation hardly grows on it. But that buffer, as far as our critical area ordinance is concerned, is an excellent quality buffer, because the assumption is that all buffers out there are native vegetation, forested communities, and high quality buffers. And so we ought to be able to recognize that there are degraded conditions and that enhancement of buffers should be encouraged and promoted in order to provide for the functionality that a buffer is supposed to be providing. There's nothing in the ordinance, and really not much recognition, that all buffers aren't created equal. But as long as I'm coming, I'm going to applaud some things, and that is the wildlife corridor idea. I think that that's a good thing. I think connected areas for wildlife to travel back and forth is a good thing. I don't know how often I'll get to use it, because most of our projects in Kitsap County are smaller in scale, 5 acres, maybe 10 acres. It's not very often that I get to do a 100-acre project. And those are the kinds of places where the application will be more easily applied. However, I think it should be incentivized, and it should be incentivized as much as possible so that it can be used on the smaller projects with some benefit. I was kind of encouraged that when it comes to buffer discussion, there were some increases and there were some decreases. And I guess I always think about it in terms of when we started the Growth Management Act, when it came in, it was because we wanted to stop sprawl. But every time we increase a buffer or create a new critical area and protect more land and set it aside in our urban growth areas, we are creating a sprawl of a different animal. It's still reducing the overall density in our urban areas. So the next time when we come around on a comprehensive planning cycle and the increase in buffers or the addition of new critical areas will reduce the available land within that growth management area, And so we're just kind of getting sprawled back again. It's just that we don't have it in our backyard. It's in a protected open space. Lastly, I wanted to say mitigation of impacted wetlands, it's an important tool to keep. I don't really see it happening all that often in my private sector projects, but I do see it a lot when we think about our public sector, when we think about the duties of our government to provide infrastructure, provide roads. They need that tool as much as anybody does. And so when we look at these protections, we need to think, I think, a little bit about how it's going to impact the cost of our government to provide these services. And they need the tools, too. That's all I have.
I have a question. You mentioned the importance of what you explained as enhancing buffers, and that it should be encouraged. In what way would you suggest? Are you suggesting that there be some process to define a particular, what sort of level of enhancement it should be given, or if it's not a very useful buffer, how would you suggest going about something like that?
Well, we could look at it and identify a degraded horse pasture. I mean, we can identify what types of buffers aren't equal to other types of buffers. But I really think that we should be able to rely on county staff to have some judgment and discerning ability to figure out what is not a good buffer and what is a good buffer and where buffer enhancement could help. And if it would help, could you reduce the buffer? Can you reduce the buffer through enhancement? And that's a tool that I think planning staff ought to have.
So it would be through a review process, though?
Yes, it would.
Mr. Coleman, my question was actually very much like Gina's. It was the idea that if we are giving back by enhancing something that benefits wildlife, in theory, you know, could we do that by taking an upgrade to 25 feet and asking for the other 25 if the original buffer was 50, for example. Your point being, if it doesn't serve its purpose, could we use some of it and make some of it actually serve its purpose?
Right. I would suspect that a 25-foot vegetated buffer, even if it's with shrubs and not trees, is going to be better than that degraded horse pasture at 50 feet.
Because what's there now doesn't draw a deer or a bird or anything else.
One projection I can make is that in 5 years' time, it will be a blackberry patch.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next, Sean Williams.
I am Sean Williams with EnviroSun Consulting. We had attended a workshop with the county and appreciated their time going over the critical areas work. Obviously, my concerns would be with the steep slopes, hazardous areas. Pretty much we went over some basic details with the maps and some of the requirements that were being stated as far as being more clear or looking at not being as conservative. Dealing with the stormwater criteria, which is just kicking in this year, I would tend to agree with the building association with a 6-month delay because stormwater still being implemented, still being interpreted, especially on the residential side. And implementing this in concurrence, even though it's piggybacking, quote unquote, the stormwater, I think a delay would be helpful in the process for both mainly the people developing, homeowners, and the builders. Any questions?
I have a question, actually, because I believe you submitted some information. Just curious, I know the geotechnical portion of this was the portion that was actually rewritten the most and modified the most. Not to put you on the spot, but I guess, are there any, I guess, particular areas that really seem to have quite a departure from where we were at previously that have major impacts?
Well, we did discuss current setback, just examples, moderate hazard slopes have 40-foot setbacks. Under new criteria, you're looking at 200-foot setbacks. So obviously that's a bigger, you're opening it up for moving homes further back, or as much as I like more work, I have plenty of work now. I don't need any more. That would be one example of what's specifically going to impact homeowners. One of the things we discussed was the criteria 300. There's actually a 300-foot criteria with the coastal zone atlas map with critical area slopes. We had discussed for the intermediate, which is just simply steep slopes, reducing that to 200 feet to be consistent. At a certain point, you keep increasing the buffers, you're going to be having to have, you're going to either can't build, it's going to make it probable for someone to build on their lot, or you're going to be dealing with higher costs that may not necessarily be applicable. And the biggest issue are the costs.
Sean, I know a couple of situations. I'll pick President's point, okay? Out of past Kingston, where all of that is, you know, steep slope, edge of the cliff, at least moderate on the map.
Correct.
I can think of entire blocks that become unbuildable if that number switched from 40 to 200.
Well, again, let's be clear, just like with the 40, it's a guideline. So the 300-foot setback, if it goes to a 300-foot setback, you can encroach upon that, but the geotech is going to have the onus on them to be putting our stamps, liability insurance, everything else out there to encroach on that. So even though it's a recommendation of 300 feet, you can encroach on that, but again, you're going to be increasing costs based on the geotech. The county's going to have to accept a certain type of report for their liability standards, because our own purpose, unfortunately, is we're an insurance policy for the most part for the county.
And is it true, just as a natural conceptual standard, that slopes like President's Point, for example, or we have a lot like those in the county, what's natural slough off, just wind-blown rain, et cetera? I've been told it's like 4 inches a year on average.
Depending on where you are,
of course,
the average is going can range from 2 to 6 inches, and all that means is you may go 3 or 4 years with 1 inch and make your grade, and then on the fifth year you have a foot.
Right.
So again, depending where you are, that's ballpark number six. And then obviously, if you're building on the site and you alter things, that can increase the process.
I mostly bring it up for relativity. Okay, 4 inches versus switching from 40 feet to 200 feet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess one other question. In the proposed plan, I know they have different variations. You know, just a letter from the geotech, an actual geotechnical report. Just out of curiosity, when you're reading this, does it appear like there's going to be more instances where you're going to be doing more report writing as opposed to letter writing, as opposed to what the code is now, or is it pretty similar, or are you able to comment on that?
Based on the meeting that we had with the county, the letter is a good idea, per se, where you have someone come out to look at it and say, your site's okay. But also conversely, the example to give them, and we're just going to go with extremes here, you have a 5-acre site, you have one steep slope on that site, but it may be within 200 feet of where you're going to build a house. You'll have to have me come out, generate a letter and say it's safe. And if it has a stream, you'll have to have somebody like Robin Myers, well, just come out, generate a letter saying it's okay. So even for, quote, a good site, there's going to be X amount of fee that the homeowner's going to be putting out. As far as the reports, the 200-foot setback, again, depending where you are, you're probably still looking at a slope assessment report, which is the lesser cost for most geologists, geotechs. You start getting pressing points or other areas, trying to encroach on the slopes for a view, you're going to get into geotechnical. So short answer is we're going to be generating more reports. It's just a matter of, it's going to be case by case and just kind of going to be a learning curve as we go through this.
Okay.
As most people do when we're having discussions like this, trying to imply some ballpark, we're not going to hold you to the number, but what is the cost implication in theory to every homeowner that changes their footprint from this point forward? Did we just potentially add $3,000 to the cost of any project because you're going to be involved in 90% more of them? What does that look like?
Anyone on the spot.
No. Take your time. I have a calculator. I mean,
we submitted the Builders Association, I believe, submitted the cost. Robin Myers and myself came up with the cost just based on the scenarios, just common scenarios, which was submitted by the Building Association. Short answer to your question. If you're doing an addition, you're just doing slope assessments, ballpark figure for most consultants in Kitsap County, it's going to be $1,500 for a slope assessment. If we're coming out just to do the letter, saying you're okay, you're looking at about $750 for the geotech. Geotechnical reports can range from $5,000 on up, depending on each individual line.
Thank you.
And the last speaker for the evening, Robin Myers.
I was late, so what do you want? My name, address, all of this stuff?
Serial number.
Thank you, Kim. So I'm Robin Myers. I'm the principal of PGE Environmental. I'm a wetland professional, or a professional wetland scientist, which you're not familiar with, is an accredited, it's an internationally accredited certification for professionals to practice wetland science on all different kinds of disciplines throughout the world. I also sit on that certification board as president-elect right now and secretary general. So, I was fortunate enough to be a county employee the last round of critical area changes, so that was an experience, and I went thoroughly through the white papers and all that type of thing. So very interestingly enough, I've been practicing it on the ground and have clients that go from single family residential to high upper end developers around the nation, actually. So I heard a lot of great stuff coming out of most everyone about the tools necessary to get some practical application of protection of wetland streams from all the other speakers. So I wanted to just basically touch base with what I found from science. I want to make sure that you understand that ecology, in their language, they basically said that their recommendation on buffer widths and mitigation ratios are general, and that there may be some wetlands for which these recommendations are either too restrictive or not protective enough. That came straight out of their guidance for this new update. They also put their rating buffers together, put their buffer widths tables together, based on the assumption that the buffer is well vegetated with native species. Mark Corman talked about this quite a bit, saying more often than not, we have degraded pastures, degraded conditions, Himalayan blackberry thickets or hedge rows along properties that are considered buffers by the code, the critical area ordinance. But ecology's ratings, their standards, are based on that native complex, forested shrub and ground cover complexes. So these large buffers are based on that quality of wetland, or buffer. So they basically also state that if the buffer is not adequately vegetated, that the buffer should be planted rather than be increased. I have a few points in the code that I have some concerns with. One is there's a decrease in our ability to use a wetland for other types of mitigation or replace it for function. We went from 2,500 square feet down to 1,000 square feet for category 3. We went from 7,500 to 4,000 square feet for category 4. Reducing these, I don't know what the impacts are going to be, but you're taking out small degraded, non-high-functioning wetland areas in which we use for stormwater now, since it's very difficult to try to manage our stormwater, and these small wetlands are perfect to recreate our stormwater facilities on. It also is going to create a little bit more of a land grab and push the development into maybe other areas. So I'm not really sure what that, what those decreases are from, but I can see there are some implications with the outcomes for that. But for averaging, it's been touched on. We currently have a buffer reduction or buffer averaging option down to 50%. It's being recommended to go to 25%. Again, I'm going to take right out of ecology's guidance that says there is no scientific information available to determine if averaging the widths of buffers actually protects functions of the wetlands. Now, if you say that another way, there is no scientific information available to determine if averaging the widths of buffers does not adequately protect functions of wetlands. Consider that when you want to reduce from 50% or go from 50% to a 25% maximum. Let's see. There are technical flaws in the buffer reduction and the low impact habitat alternative. I believe there was a table. I don't really know how to get into the science, but ecology doesn't want to support any type of buffer reduction. However, their alternative is a buffer, a 25% reduction alternative, although it has the constraints of doing of connecting corridors. I believe it was Mark that commented on that. So you connect with large corridors, application with adjacent property owners, those types of things. None. Out of time, if you'll allow.
If you work towards wrapping up, yes.
Okay. So mitigation ratios, again, I'm gonna jump on Mark's coattails, something I never considered in regard to larger municipality requirements for wetland fill. We really don't encounter that very often on any level, single family or commercial. The increase in ratios are unfounded, according to the science that I've read. They're just higher. So that puts higher costs, higher implications, higher needs for municipalities to support our infrastructure. One thing too, any studies that have been done by ecology on mitigation success is based on the fact that there is no compliance. Not that it doesn't work, that putting a wetland over here or enhancing or restoring doesn't work, it's that compliance measures fail. Nobody's following up on it, neither the developer or the leading regulatory agency. And I will wrap it up. Consider retaining the vehicles for the buffer reductions for 50% buffer averaging with consideration or interpretation to protect and preserve corridors. That's very clear in the science, these corridors. We can see these corridors. We understand where they are in Kitsap County. You have institutional knowledge of staff and your local professionals to do this right, to develop correctly. Site-specific flexibility is critical to our wetland streams and watersheds. At this point, I feel we're getting into the hard stuff in regard to redevelopment, renewal of our commercial corridors, redevelopment and renewal in our residential areas. So existing non-conforming uses have both the opportunity to improve or degrade our resources. But if we don't have the right tools, we're not going to be able to get there to protect both the watershed resources and homeowners' rights to redevelop. And I'll skip some
any,
of the rest
any
of
questions it. For her?
Yes, could you submit your notes in you writing? I would appreciate that.
You bet.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you. So, excuse me, that's the last person that signed up for this evening. As stated, there is another public hearing in Paulsbo on Thursday, another one at the county courthouse a week from tonight. So you're welcome to come and attend those and speak if you would like to. Any, I guess, questions for staff? Any comments? No?
No, that went well.
Okay. So we'll obviously adjourn the meeting, but the public hearing technically stays open because we're having several more meetings. So thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Do they need to make that motion? Do they need to make that motion, though? To keep it open? So they need to make a motion to keep the public hearing open.
Do see they need to make a motion.
Do they? I don't know.
They didn't adjourn the, they didn't close the hearing.
Oh, just the meeting.
They didn't close the public hearing.
The hearing is still
okay.
Open, so
yeah.
As long as it's
okay. Just check.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I told them that they could get us the mistaken materials, but what they pointed to was like